Hello, and welcome to episode 27 of the History of Yugoslav Football podcast, and the fourth part of our look at the Golden Age. Chile. 1960 had been a massive success for Yugoslavia. Euro 1960 and the Olympics showed that Yugoslavia not only had a national side that was one of the best in Europe, but it had depth in the Olympic side of players who would grow into the national setup for years to come. Yet the side was swiftly brought to earth. Their two games following those championships would be a draw and a defeat to Hungary. The latter of those was in Budapest, and concerningly, saw it be more or less the first choice team swept aside 4-2. It was not the best lead-in to the World Cup qualifiers. The rather odd World Cup qualifiers. This time, the qualifiers were odd because of withdrawals leaving some of the UEFA groups short a team. The result was 7 3-team groups, 1 5-team group, and 2 2-team groups. So, before we get into what actually happened, it's worth noting that UEFA could have just shifted 2 teams out of the 5-team group into the 2-2-team groups and avoided a lot of complication. Yugoslavia were placed into a 2-team group against Poland and the withdrawn Iceland. Yugoslavia would progress 3-2 on aggregate in a tight tie against the Poles, thanks to an away goal from Milan Galic killing the tie early in the second leg. But the fun was only just beginning. While Spain, the other team to come out of a 2-team group, were given an inter-confederational playoff against Morocco, a country which geography fans will note literally borders Spain, Yugoslavia were put into an inter-confederational playoff against an Asian side, namely South Korea, a country which geography fans will note is literally 8,000 kilometres from Yugoslavia. One slight footnote to this is that in between the two legs of the Poland tie, Yugoslavia won a friendly 3-2. Their opponents? Morocco. But to Asia it was. A 5-1 first leg victory at the JNA was the prelude to an extensive tour of Asia. Before they set off, Austria would be beaten at Maksimir in advance of the trip to Seoul. A 3-1 win in the South Korean capital would send Yugoslavia to the World Cup with an 8-2 aggregate victory. Next on the list would be a 1-0 win in Tokyo against Japan, with Zvezdan Sebinac scoring the only goal, before a 2-1 win in Hong Kong against the Principalities side. A 5-1 win in Indonesia would round off the East Asian leg before stopping off in Tel Aviv on the way back home for a 2-0 win over Israel. 1961 was a resounding success for the team, with only one major change. Aleksandar Tijanić departing the dugout for the first extended period since the end of World War II. 1961 was also a banner year for Tito, as it was the culmination of work that saw the official setup of the non-aligned movement. The scheme had become near inevitable since 1956 and the signing of the Declaration of Brioni between Yugoslavia, India and Egypt to help with peace and guarding their own independence, which started the road to formalising backroom talks towards this sort of initiative between Tito and mainly Asian representatives, who had all individually noted their wish to be entirely neutral in the Cold War. Some were serious, like Yugoslavia, some which were somewhat less neutral, like Cuba. Tito would chair the meeting that would set up the non-aligned movement and get most of the prestige and plaudits, positioning Yugoslavia as a major world power at the head of a major bloc of nations and, most importantly, use that diplomatic heft to improve his bargaining power with both the USA and the USSR. These efforts had both the intended consequences and some rather entertaining unintended ones. As an example, Tito's moves to woo Mexico led to the so-called U-Mex craze. Mexican movies were shown in theatres as Soviet and US movies either didn't show the right values or showed a higher standard of living through capitalism. The result was that Mexican influences became important in the 1950s and 60s, with there being honest-to-God popular Serbian and Croatian mariachi bands, with popular singers such as Nikola Karavic, Slavko Perovic and Ljubomir Milic. Legend has it that Tito enjoyed some of the music so much, one of Karavic's recordings of the song Malguina Salerosa features none other than Yugoslavia's leader himself on the piano. These efforts in creating ties outside of the big two world powers were well timed. During the Hungarian Revolution, Tito had earned the ire of the USSR by harboring the overthrown communist leader Imre Nagy in the Yugoslav embassy in Budapest. Tito had liked Nagy as he had wanted to see Hungary throw off the shackles of the USSR and offered him safe harbour when the revolution showed that the USSR actually wanted to throw shackles upon Hungary. The result was an improvement in relations with the West and a swift decline in them with the USSR, after the Soviets lured Nagy out of the embassy with the promise of safe transit to exile in Yugoslavia, and, instead of safely transiting him, kidnapped and executed him. Internally, the disputes between central direction and market forces continued, and while Yugoslavia boomed, these would eventually move towards major controversy in the middle of this decade. That, however, is a little way off, and first on the agenda for Yugoslavia would be travelling to Chile. The national side played only one game in 1962 prior to the World Cup, a 3-1 warm-up win over East Germany, with the new management team of Ljubomir Lovric and Pyroslav Mihailovic. Lovric had been part of the national setup since 59, with Lovric coming in 61. The team that went to Chile was wildly different to that of 4 years prior. Only 7 of the players had earned more than 10 caps prior to the championships, with captaincy of the side going to 24-year-old Milan Galic. 3 uncapped players even went to the tournament, most notably Vojkan Milic. Save for the issues in UEFA qualifying, everything ran smoothly, even in trying circumstances. All 16 teams turned up, and group seedings were sensible, with no outright group of death, unlike 1958. This was all achieved in spite of, in 1960, Chile experiencing the Valdivia earthquake, the most powerful earthquake ever recorded at a 9.6, with a tsunami following it. The resulting damage meant a large change in the locations of the tournament. Damage meant that 4 venues had to be completely discarded, while the forced change in government spending priorities to sort out the recovery meant that 2 others in Antofagasta and Valparaiso had to be stopped due to not being sustainable. 1 venue, the Estadio Sausalito in Viña del Mar, did have the funding to be rebuilt, while the venue in Arica was a new build and will be renamed the Estadio Carlos Dietborn, hosting all of the games in Yugoslavia's group, Group 1. The Estadio El Teniente, then the Estadio Braden Cooper Company, will be rushed into use, as its US mining company owners permitted use after the enforced cancellation of other stadiums. The inevitable result was a World Cup that was far smaller than originally planned, due to a lower amount of venues, and, aside from the national stadium itself in Santiago, stadiums that were relatively low capacity. The stadium in Arica, where Yugoslavia were based, was only 17,500, and in spite of having 2 South American sides in the group, would not break the 10,000 attendance mark in the group stage. Yugoslavia had been thrown in against Colombia, Uruguay, and old rivals, the USSR. Their opening game against the USSR would be the first World Cup game of Yugoslavia's for which we have coverage in colour. It would, however, be a game that, like much of the tournament, was blighted by aggressive play. The USSR would spend much of the game on top, with Mitrovelli having a goal disallowed for offside early on. When Yugoslavia were in attack, it mainly came through Šeki. After a goalless first half, the USSR would go ahead early in the second. Ponedelnik struck a free kick from 30 yards out, which cracked the corner of post and bar. With Suskic having committed himself and gotten a touch to the free kick, the rebound was easy for Ivanov to nod into an empty net. Tempers would flare. Drazen Jerković saw no punishment after kicking the referee before tragedy would hit. Mohamed Mujic would chase a long ball down and then would go in late on Dubinsky in the USSR defence, breaking Edvard Dubinsky's leg. Lev Yashin would end up having to carry Dubinsky off the pitch. Mujic would not receive punishment on the pitch, but would be sent home by the Federation after the game, never to play international football again. Ponedelnik would finish the scoring with an angled finish soon after. The USSR would be victorious 2-0, and Yugoslavia's World Cup campaign will get off to the worst possible start. Mitrovelli would go down the tunnel with stitches around his eye, while Jerković continued arguing with the referee down into the changing rooms. At least this time he didn't boot him. As for Edvard Dubinsky, he would suffer complications from his broken leg, namely cancerous sarcoma, which would, after having a leg amputated in 1968, cause complications that would claim his life, aged only 34. It was hardly the only incident in a World Cup littered with them. In the other first group game, Colombia had gone in through Francisco Zuluaga until Uruguay essentially kicked him off the park and then came back to win. While Yugoslavia and the USSR were playing, the Czechs were fighting Spain, with the Czech team laying into the Spanish side before the Spaniards chose to fight fire with fire, causing injuries in their own ranks. It would, however, not compare to what went on in Group B and the so-called Battle of Santiago between Chile and Italy. That fixture was already high risk. Italian journalists had described Chile in none too flattering terms, and the respective journalistic corps of each nation appeared to take it in turns to see who could racially abuse the other the most. According to the Italian side, Chile was a dump where the population were impoverished, illiterate alcoholics. According to the Chilean side, Italians were oversexed, fascist junkies. The Italians who had written the original hit piece about the nation were forced to flee the country, and an Argentinian writer was beaten up in Santiago for, well, looking a bit Italian. When it came to the game itself, the first sending off was after 8 minutes to Giorgio Farini, who would have to be dragged off the pitch by police. After that, the teams were essentially engaged in a minor war. Chile, as the home team, did it because the referee allowed them to get away with things like punching Italians in the face, and Italy did it because if they didn't, they wouldn't survive. Next up for Yugoslavia was another old nemesis, Uruguay, who vanquished them in 1930. This time, however, Yugoslavia had Šeki, who imposed himself early on by dribbling through the entire defence and going close. It would be Uruguay who would take the lead, though, as a defensive clearance was intercepted, and the Uruguayans quickly got in behind and crossed for Cabrera to nod home in the 19th minute. That would be where the good news ended for the South Americans. Jerković received the ball in the box, turned Alvarez and was brought down. Josip Skoblar put the penalty low into the corner to bring the scores level. It would soon be two. The ball broke to Šeki on the edge of the box, who drilled it at goal. Roberto Sosa saved, but parried it only to the feet of Milan Galic, who put Yugoslavia ahead. Jerković would make it 3-1 early in the second half. A long ball up to the front was met by Galic, who turned his marker inside and out before crossing in for an easy, headed finish for Jerković. It left a must-win final game against Colombia, who had drawn against the USSR, coming from 3-0 and 4-1 down to draw 4-all, including an Olympic goal from Marcos Coll. This game, however, would be a much more clear-cut affair. Gali would Krstic would begin the scoring with a neat run and finish on 20 minutes, before Jurkovic would be set free in the box 5 minutes later to double Yugoslavia's advantage. It would primarily be one-way traffic. Galic would score again on the hour mark with a diving header. Melic would make it 4 from the edge of the box with 8 minutes to go, Galic assisting. Finally, Jurkovic would score from a one-on-one with 2 minutes to go to put Yugoslavia through to the quarterfinals comfortably. As runners-up of Group 1, they would take on the winners of Group 2. That side would be their nemesis of the past two World Cups, West Germany. This time, there would be no early goals. Instead, it would go to the death. Seeler would hit the post early, but Yugoslavia would be the ones creating most of the chances as the game wore on, and it would be Galic who would create the goal once again, battling past his marker on the left before cutting back to Radakovic to hammer it high into the net with 5 minutes remaining. The old enemy that had extinguished Yugoslavia's hopes twice before were now vanquished. At this point comes an odd little footnote. The organisers, perhaps understandably, expected Chile to win their group. When they didn't, they were sent to play their quarterfinal tie at Arica, filling that ground, while West Germany and Yugoslavia played at the National Stadium in Santiago in front of over 60,000. The organisers didn't want a repeat of this, so Chile's venue for their semi-final against Brazil would be swapped from Viña del Mar. This irritated the residents of Viña del Mar mightily, many of whom had bought tickets specifically on the basis that they'd be cheering on their home team, and boycotted the other semi-final as a result. So while 76,594 people watched Brazil beat Chile 4-2 in the National Stadium in Santiago, under 6,000 people turned out for the Battle of Eastern Europe in Czechoslovakia versus Yugoslavia. A tentative first half was punctuated by chances from distance for each side. The Czechs would take the lead on 48 minutes after Kadraba volleyed straight at Soskic, who could only parry it straight back where it came from to the Czech forward making a diving header, making no mistake second times round. The Czechs would be pegged back 20 minutes later, a hoof forward seeing Jurkovic get to the ball ahead of the keeper to nod at him. Jurkovic would have a chance to put Yugoslavia in the lead soon after, but see his shot saved. As the game entered the last 10 minutes, the Czechs would hit Yugoslavia on the break, Scherer with an easy finish. 5 minutes later, he would score from the spot after a handball in the box. The Czechs were through to the final, and Yugoslavia would lose their second World Cup semi-final. This time, at least, unlike 1930, there would actually be a definite third-placed playoff pitting Yugoslavia against the hosts, Chile, that would, as I'm sure you've perhaps gathered by the retelling of the Battle of Santiago, be refereed with the benefit of the home team in mind. Kovacevic would have a goal chalked off early, after play was called back late for a handball to prevent the advantage after great combinations between Galic and Šeki. Kovacevic would have a second goal chalked off in the second half for a dubious offside, and Chile's Rojas would score the only goal of the game, a deflected strike from distance to send the fans home happy. Happy also were Yugoslavia at their performance. With a promising young side, they had achieved plenty, with Šeki and Galic being two of the true stars of the entire tournament. Surely, this was to be the dawn of a new footballing superpower. Next time on the podcast, the golden age comes to an end, as Partizan's babies look for an unprecedented 3 in a row, and as a little team called Trestnievka start their short journey in the First League. Thank you for listening, and I'll catch you next time.